3:30, Francis Davis hosts Interval, a program of jazz music and commentary. Today, part two of Francis's series on the out-of-print work of pianist Paul Bley. Poets Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams, who broke with the traditions of poetry to develop new forms and a new understanding of language and cadence, were awarded degrees at the University of Pennsylvania 75 years ago. In the spring, Penn commemorated this anniversary by inviting poets and scholars to participate in the Pound-Williams Conference. WUHY's Maeve McGoran has produced a two-part series of highlights from this symposium. We heard the first part yesterday at 3, on part 2, today at 3. We'll hear from the founder of New Directions Press, James Lachlan, who published Pound and Williams, and he'll read from letters that they wrote to him. And also, poet Wendy Starlert-Flory will discuss what's come to be known as the Pound Problem, as anti-Semitism in support of Mussolini during World War II. So that's coming up at 3 o'clock today. Malvina Reynolds is remembered for her songs and performances, and for her feminism, wit, and humanitarianism, which they reflected. Her best-known songs include Little Boxes and What Have They Done to the Rain. Today at 2:45, we'll hear a short documentary about Reynolds, featuring interviews with her daughter, Pete Seeger, and Margie Adam. With me now on Fresh Air is Lloyd Alexander, the author of many award-winning fantasy books for children. As a young man, he says a search for adventure led him to join the military in World War II, where he learned that he was more adventurous in his imagination than he was in real life. After working in combat intelligence in France and Germany, and in a counterintelligence unit in Paris, he moved back to the Philadelphia area, where he began to write numerous novels that nobody would publish. He spent 10 years writing for adults, including his translations of the work of Jean-Paul Sartre and Paul Eluard that were, by the way, published by New Directions Press. But he says it was when he started writing fantasy books for children that he felt he really connected with his deepest feelings. In 1969, he was awarded the Newbery Medal for his last book in the Prydain cycle, The High King. In 1971, his book, The Marvelous Misadventures of Sebastian, received the National Book Award for Children's Literature. His recent book, The First Two Lives of Lucas Kasha, received the Dutch Silver Slate Pencil. That's the Netherlands' most prestigious award for books for young people. The Marvelous Misadventures of Sebastian is being serialized on Japanese television, and Disney Productions are planning an animated film based on his book, The Black Cauldron. His new book, Westmark, is an adventure populated with a fugitive, kings, queens, revolutionaries, and spiritualists. Like all of his books, Westmark is published by Dutton. Lloyd Alexander, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Are all your personal adult obsessions hidden somewhere in your children's books?
I wouldn't even say they were hidden. I'd say they were there, quite obvious for anybody to find.
One thing that I know is that you're a violinist.
And am I ever? Thank you for using that term. I've been called otherwise.
And there are a number of characters who play violin in various books.
Yes, they do better than I, but that's even sort of on the surface. But I think digging down a little deeper, certainly my concerns must be reflected in what I do, which it's true of any writer, seems to me.
We translated the work of Sartre, whose ideas are very complex and abstract. How does something like that work its way into children's fantasy books?
Well, in that case, it wouldn't work its way in on a one-to-one basis. In other words, a book wouldn't be a primer of existentialism or what have you. But certainly any intellectual idea that you are interested in is going to show up one way or another.
Were you caught up in the idea of adventure when you were young?
Oh, yes. Too many Victor McLaughlin movies. I thought, oh, this is going to be great. Yes, I had the insane idea of joining the Army. And I envisioned to myself that I would join, I would be slightly wounded, not seriously, but a little slightly, and would be tended by, obviously, a gorgeous nurse of some kind, and everything would be marvelous.
I've seen that movie.
That's the movie. Yeah, I saw that. And I realized this was not the case. It took me a while to realize it. I think about 1 minute after they swore me in. And from that moment, I bent every effort to get out as fast as I could. It took me 3.5 years.
Well, what did that do to your idea of adventure?
It made me a realist.
Not as a writer, though.
No. Well, I guess I still, somewhere in the back of my mind, I have a sneaking urge for it. I know better, being older, but not too much wiser, and I still, I imagine it. No, fascinating. Here's an interesting idea. I wonder sometimes if I write adventure stories, or say on the surface, adventure stories or what have you, because maybe at heart, really, I'm a basic coward. I'm constantly telling myself, shape up and act heroically, which I doubt that I ever will, but this may be some kind of motivation for it. I don't know.
I think a lot of my early imaginative adventures were inspired by locations of television serials and of course movies. So I mean, I had, you know, like a buccaneer and pirate adventures in my head because there were series like on TV.
Yeah, these are very stirring
cowboy
things.
Fantasies and things like that. Well, yours came from movies and what else? Where did your fantasies take place?
I guess the source mainly. Don't forget, I grew up in the days of radio. For one thing, television didn't exist, so that I had radio. Occasional movies, Saturday matinee and so on, but I was an enormous reader, which is strange because my parents were not readers. To the best of my knowledge, neither one of them ever cracked a book, but we had books around the house, I suppose, to add to the furniture or something, and I read, from as far back as I can remember, everything as a child. I did not read children's books as such. I would grab anything off the shelf, and I would read it. And I read what a mixture of things you wouldn't believe. And this is where my fantasies came from.
As a writer, what do you think are some of the special qualities of fantasy books for your readers?
Oh, maybe I've got another week to answer that question. All right, let me see a couple of things. Well, first, and I got to try this idea out on you and try it out on myself, too. I think that fantasy works on emotional levels in ways that realism doesn't. And I'm not putting down realism or making any kind of value judgment. For some reason, fantasy, or at least the form of fantasy, seems to strike very deep levels in all of us. The reason for that, I don't know. I could only guess. The closest thing I would come to, and I don't necessarily believe it, it's a very poetic idea, and I hope it's true. If it isn't true, it ought to be. The idea of Jungian archetypes. Jung's theory, which is a beautiful theory, that the human race shares a collective unconscious. That somehow lurking in the backs of our minds of every human being, in all cultures at all times, there's a kind of set of characters. Jung called them archetypes, and if you run through those characters, you almost automatically have a certain type of fantasy or fairy tale. For example, you have the young man, the young woman, the kindly old man, the wicked enchanter, the wicked stepmother, the kindly grandmother or mother or whatever, the helpful animal. You have a figure called the shadow, which is a kind of nemesis that works among them, and some others. And these characters seem almost to be permanently fixed in our unconscious. And I often wonder if works that draw in one way or another, either directly or in some disguised way, if this is not an enormous source of strength, and it gives that kind of fantasy a very moving quality, which you don't quite get in realism. And I think, too, possibly, all right, generally speaking, fantasy deals in metaphor. To the extent if you say, all right, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. This is an image which strikes immediately. In fantasy, you have somebody looking a gift horse in the mouth, and the image works directly. You don't quite do that in realism. I remember some years ago, a marvelous novelist, Mae Sarton, great poet too, told me that she envied me writing fantasy because I don't have to keep emptying the ashtrays.
Oh, in the stories.
Yes, that whereas she, as a realistic novelist, she was complaining, said, I've got to empty the ashtrays, I've got to have the furniture, I've got to have the curtains and all that. fantasy. You don't have to worry about the ashtrays.
That's a really nice way of putting it.
Yes, a brilliant way of putting it.
Well, one of the things that you can do in a fantasy book is put your characters through magical and impossible journeys. And
yes.
In your book, The Two Lives of Lucas Kasha, there's a beautiful image in the beginning of the book that sets up the journey that he goes on through the remainder of the book. Can you describe what happens to him? It's really
well,
a beautiful image.
Yes, and it's a very ancient image. In fact, as far as I know, it comes from the Arabian Nights, and even before then, because even when the Arabian Nights was composed, this was still an ancient idea. And it's very simply the idea that, well, all right, specifically in Lucas Kasha, that here is this young rascal who is a complete layabout and a ne'er-do-well and everything else, comes across a traveling charlatan who invites him to stick his head in a bucket of water, which he does, and instantaneously he finds himself drowning in the ocean. And he crawls out and finds himself in a completely different, exotic world that he has never seen before in his life. It resembles ancient Persia, in fact, which is my relation. This is sort of shows where the source comes from. And he lives out, in effect, a real life. This is the central part of the book. And real things happen to him. It is not a dream. Because I think using dreams as such is cheating.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he didn't go to sleep and I dreamed it and then I woke up and everything is all right. He actually lives out his life and in very dangerous circumstances. And in the course of it, he changes from being a kind of irresponsible rascal to acquiring some sense of how the world goes and a feeling of responsibility. He has something to do. And, of course, he falls in love, which he must. And I dare tell the ending. It's, I don't know. I hate to do that. Well, okay. All right, I'll tell you. You know the ending. At a certain point, there's not a happy ending to that episode. It's almost a tragic ending that he is abruptly torn from this place that he had started living in, ready to spend the rest of his life there. I say he's fallen in love and his life is finally working out all right. And he is ripped from that suddenly in a very violent and brutal way, finds himself exactly back where he was. Apparently, no time has passed. His head is still dripping from the bucket, and he's in terrible anguish because he wants to go back. This is the life that he wants. He found himself, in effect, in that world, and he cannot get back to it. The charlatan leaves town, says, goodbye, there's nothing I can do for you. And as I say, he is in serious anguish that something significant has happened to him, and he can't recapture it. But he still maintains what he learned there and the experiences he had. And he realized, in effect, you can't go home again. He has outgrown his former personality. He's outgrown the small town that he's lived in, and he feels that he has to leave. And, of course, the great touch is that he becomes a traveling storyteller. And the first story that he tells begins once upon a time in Abadan, which is what had just happened to him. It's a fascinating structure.
Yeah, it really is, and it... Well, there's stories about the importance of storytelling, and I'm thinking of like a 1001 Arabian
yes.
Nights and Scheherazade.
Yes.
And who saves her life by telling
yes, he,
wonderful
leave,
stories
right. leave,
every
leaves
evening.
It unfinished.
So when you were going back through Persian history and the writing of the Lucas Kasha book, was there a lot of emphasis on beautiful storytelling?
Yes, yes, indeed. Storytellers then. And as a matter of fact, even today in a great many different parts of the world are almost magical beings. Well, even in Western culture, the bardic tradition is a tradition of poetry, of storytelling. And it's a very ancient tradition, and the great part of it is an oral tradition. That is, it's an ear tradition. One of my ideas is that the closer in writing that we can convey a sense of speech, if we can appeal to the ear, this is also a great strength. that a book is not, all right, it's a printed medium, obviously so, but if there is some kind of verbal quality to it, if you can hear it inside your head, I think this is an enormous strength. My theory is, which I won't push too far, that great books can be read aloud. And it does seem to work. Dickens is marvelous to read aloud. So is Mark Twain, a great many others. There is a verbal quality to it that, as I say, is very ancient. And that, too, seems to trigger off very deep responses. And what I wish is that we would tell each other stories much more than we do, because it's an incredible experience. Parents, or even families, are missing something marvelous if they don't, for example, read to each other.
You know, one of the things that I think has like substituted for storytelling, and it works really well in our culture, is just rapping. You know, like some people are just really good to have a good rap, and they could tell a good story.
That's right.
Or just lay a good rap
That's
on
great.
You. And the all of the important things about speech are in that,
yes.
even though it's not an ancient story that they're
No, it's probably as ancient as any other form. No, the interesting thing is that a good story is good gossip.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's nice.
It has the same attractiveness. So, sure, a rap session is a great thing. But on the other hand, a storytelling, or the telling of a tale, is a slightly different experience, too. And it's very powerful in itself. And you don't have to be very good at it. This is the amazing thing. It's almost the difference between recorded music and live music. That here is a human being who is sitting there in your presence saying something to you, and it's quite remarkable.
Let's talk a little bit about The Marvelous Misadventures of Sebastian. In the beginning of that, Sebastian is a violinist, and he takes the rap for someone. Plays this really god-awful note on the violin, and just to save himself... Why don't you explain how he ends up taking the rap for something he didn't do?
Sebastian, being a fourth violin in a princely aristocratic chamber orchestra, is called upon to play with his colleagues on the occasion of the visit of a perfectly despicable character. And in the course of it, one of his fellow musicians, his bow skids up the string, and it sounds horrible. And this despicable villain is just bowing very gracefully at the time to his noble host. And, of course, he feels that the back of his britches have split or something even worse than that. And he is furious. Now, the musician who did that was a very old and unfortunate person and not able to stand this kind of blame and censure that was surely going to fall on him. So Sebastian, who was a very good-natured rascal to begin with, he changes in the course of it, out of the kindness of his heart, takes the blame. His shoulders are broad. He can stand it. In consequence, he loses his job. Virtue is not rewarded.
He's virtually exiled.
Indeed he is. He's thrown out into the world, which is a terrible place to be thrown into.
Now, one of the things that I know a lot of children's writers try to instill in their young readers is that, do unto others, do whatever others do unto you, and if you do well, you'll be done well in turn. And here's an example of someone who takes the rap for someone else and ends up getting thrown out of
yes,
his home,
indeed,
out into the world. And it doesn't work. He did a good deed, and he's punished for it.
Very often, this unfortunately is the way it happens. In other words, your first proposition is fine. Can't disagree with it. Do unto others and so forth. It's the great Hillel asked, can you sum up the law in one law? And he said, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Everything else is commentary. And I agree with that. It doesn't always or necessarily work that way. It's a hard truth. And it's the kind of truth that I think is a disservice, not only to kids, but it's a disservice to adults. To pretend that, virtue, well, no, virtue is its own reward. Virtue is about its only reward. And it's a very hard idea. It's a very unsettling idea. But these are the hard facts of the matter. Actually, it's no secret, because everybody over the age of six knows it. And we are deluding ourselves if we think it is always going to be that way. Sometimes it does work out. Sometimes things work out marvelously. There are occasionally happy endings, just as often not. But we are quite aware of that. And as I say, to try to pretend otherwise, certainly in art, where you're supposed to tell the truth, because what else can you tell? This is a terrible disservice to the young or old. It's a delusion. And there's an enormous difference between a delusion and an illusion. An illusion is a great way of letting us see the truth. What was Picasso's quotation? Art is a lie that allows us to see the truth. And this is illusion, which I think is great. Delusion is something else again. Delusion can only be ultimately destructive.
So, in a way, you're writing about contradictions that people have to live with, too.
Exactly.
Does that in any way go back to like your interest in Sartre or anything? You know, and because it certainly isn't a fairy tale philosophy that he's constructed.
No, it's there again. I'll say it won't go back in the direct sense of, oh yes, I learned this from Sartre.
Right.
It's simply part of my intellectual experience.
Right, of not having a simplistic, everything works out
that's
for
right.
the best in the
that's
long
right.
run.
That's right. So it's simply part of your intellectual equipment. See, the interesting thing, Terry, and it's an obvious point, but we have to keep reminding ourselves, children's books are written by grown-ups. And obviously, if you are a grown-up, and having grown up as I hope we grow up, you have lived in the world, and things have happened to you that you must use. Otherwise, you're kidding yourself, and you're kidding your readers, which is despicable.
I'm talking with writer Lloyd Alexander. If you're just joining us, one of the types of people that are commonly found in fantasy or in adventure are royalty. You know, in fairy tales also.
The oh yes,
whole
yes.
myth of the king and queen, prince and princess, and all that. And yesterday we actually, the world was witness to
a real royal
wedding. What do you think of the real thing, you know?
Well, I wouldn't have missed that for anything. First,
why not? Because,
well, as I was saying, I feel that I really should keep an eye on the royals to make sure they are not getting into mischief and doing foolish things such as trying to run the government. As long as they stay out of that, fine. They may be an expensive luxury, but they're probably a harmless one. And God knows we can all stand a certain amount of pageantry once in a while. The reality of it, we all know, is quite a different thing. I don't think royal houses, for the most part, were noted particularly, with certain big exceptions, for being, shall we say, the intellectual or moral leaders of their age. As I say, as long as they stay out of government, they're perfectly harmless and don't mind watching them. But to take royalty seriously is, realistically speaking, I think is a little bit ridiculous.
Now, one of the things that has made me a little nervous during the whole royal wedding period is knowing that no matter how hard people picture it as this fantasy book kind of coming together of people, that they probably grew up, if not with the same neuroses as us common folk, with at least
maybe a good dosage of their own,
right? So I just have this terrible, just not terrible, but this like sensation that when all the photographs are being taken and stuff and they're left together alone behind their own closed doors, that they have a strange legacy to live up to, because I think it would be impossible for their lives to have that kind of fairy tale stuff that the fairy tales are made of.
No,
they always end at the marriage anyways, unless it's the good queen, bad queen kind of stuff, and which is a lot more malicious than the happy wedding.
Well, first, as someone said, and I forget who it was, talking to Dick Cavett, that royalty, specifically the Prince of Wales, is a man without choice. He may have preferences, he may like something a little better than another, but he does not have choice. For better or worse, It's a very strange kind of life. As far as the fairy tales go, we aren't expected to take the kings and queens literally as royal individuals, because they don't, depends on the tale, but they really don't act like that. It's perfectly possible for the king to leave his palace and go knocking on the woodcutter's door, which, of course, no real king would probably do. And the idea of they lived happily ever after, which is, of course, the great traditional ending, again, I don't believe was ever meant to be taken literally. I think what it meant, the implication was that somehow whatever the problem was resolved, and that's the end of that, and you don't pursue it any more than you would say, well, what happened after Hamlet died? What did Fortinbras do? It's, in other words, the theater ends when the curtain comes down and the situation is resolved. The fairy tales do not promise that we will literally live happily ever after, and we all know that. The best we can do is hope that things may sort of work out a little better than they might have been.
Well, on the opposite end of royal weddings, you're a member of Amnesty International,
yes,
which probably has something to say about your politics. How do you use your political beliefs in your stories and in other messages about war and about peace that you want to communicate to your readers?
Indeed, there are. And yet, I'll put it this way. It's not in the sense of writing a work of some kind and then tacking on a message like an Aesop's fable. Oh, yeah, point out, this is the moral of the story. It doesn't work that way, as you know. I think what happens is that what I believe in is so much is down into the marrow of my bones, and that what I do is instinctively, automatically going to come out in certain ways. In other words, it's not taking so much, as you say, an intellectual position, or put it that the intellectual position somehow has got to filter down into the deepest part of your personality, because otherwise you, with the best intention in the world, you're writing agitprop or whatever, and it is something that is tacked on. And I think that this is inherent in the fabric of what I do, and you can't say, oh yeah, this is the message of this. It's all kind of one thing in there.
Well, there's a revolution and militia and fighting in Westmark, your new book. What's the story that you've told? Or maybe you could tell us a little of the story.
Terry, this is the first time I've talked about that book in public, and I haven't quite figured out what to say about it. To me, it's fascinating because it's somewhat different from anything I've done in a lot of different ways. It's not a fantasy in the strict sense. There is no magical element or anything like that. It's fantastic, but it is not magical. It is a very tough-minded kind of book. And I guess, essentially, well, at bottom, it's a book dealing with a great many things. It deals with the temptations of power, with the abuse of power. It deals with matters of conscience, which are always very difficult. The questions that have certainly preoccupied me for years and have preoccupied probably the whole human race from as far back as you could imagine, a question of right or wrong. I sometimes imagine to myself those first microorganisms that crawled out of the sea and finally crept up onto the shore. Probably that very moment they asked each other, hey, did we really do the right thing? So these are old questions. I have no answers to them, which is all the more reason for asking the questions. And I think, all right, here's a thought, too, that occurs to me. In Westmark, for example, all right, one of the basic conflicts, certainly in fantasy and in literature to an enormous extent, is the great conflict between good and evil. And I've come to the conclusion that, all right, this is a very serious, important idea and so on, but it is very simple. Generally speaking, let's assume that you can identify who the bad guys are, and you decide that you are a good guy. The situation becomes very easy to know what you have to deal with. In Westmark, what I was trying to do, in addition to that, because there are some very bad guys in there, as a villain that is a villain that one of the most despicable characters I've ever. I love to hate him. Oh, I had a marvelous time with him. This is a simple conflict. Where it gets difficult is not the conflict between the good guys and the bad guys. It's the conflict between the good guys and the good guys. And there you start getting caught in terrible, grinding dilemmas. It's the conflict between good and good, which can be even more harrowing and anguishing than, let's say, a conflict between good and evil. And this is what I'm trying to do in Westmark.
That's a really interesting thing to tackle. How do you give that shape in the novel?
I guess there again, I can only trust... It's not much of a good answer, but I can only trust in my instincts and what I feel and let it come out as it comes out. That if I'm thinking in those terms, the images will come out that will embody them. And I don't know how else to go about it.
Fantasy is a very popular adult genre now. Fantasy movies and fantasy books, but what do you think some of the differences are between fantasy for adults and fantasy for children?
I think essentially there isn't or shouldn't be any difference, really. Or I'll put it this way: that all right, if there is one life process, one biological life process, as I believe there is, there's one basic art process. And it takes different forms. It takes the form of music or poetry or painting, novels, so-called children's books, which are not necessarily for children. They're just books for people. It so happens that children happen to be interested in them, and adults can very well be interested in the same book. And I think, all right, certainly there are novels that are obviously going to interest children more than they're going to interest adults. I mean, you can see that for yourself, and there are books that are going to interest adults probably more than they're going to interest kids. But there's a kind of middle ground in which the book somehow speaks to both sides of the fence. I don't think there is a side of the fence. I think it's all the same thing. Childhood isn't a state, it's a process. And I think it's very difficult to say, okay, this is a child, therefore this child reads this and nothing else. So the adults, oddly enough, have been discovering recently that some superb fantasy has been published in the form of children's books. Or that is to say, they will find it in the children's section. It's there for catalog reasons, not for artistic reasons. Think, for example... The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, there is a whole genre which is marvelous. Some years ago, this was not the case. Fantasy, or I guess maybe even 10 or 12 years ago, was not in very good repute. It was considered escapist, it was considered irrelevant, and it had no bearing on the real world, which of course is not true. Fantasy can be superbly relevant, not topical.
Right.
There's a difference. Topical is one thing, relevant is something else.
Well, you were talking about archetype before and the idea that all humans carry around certain images and ideas that they share. And one of your books has recently been serialized for Japanese television. Now, granted, we share a lot more than archetypes. We share, you know, cars and hamburgers as well. But I know you haven't seen it yet, but have you imagined what it's going to look like?
I'm trying to imagine, and I don't know how they're actually going to do it graphically. I don't know whether, well, Sebastian, of course, is a kind of Mozartian European background, and I don't know whether the Japanese are going to keep it as European or whether very easily they can turn it into an Oriental atmosphere, because certainly you have the same type of historical feudal structures and aristocracy and so on. And it could work just as well. I don't know whether the characters are going to be Eastern or Western.
Do you have a preference?
No, it doesn't matter. I'm just fascinated to see how they're going to decide.
Mm-hmm.
It would work either way.
There's another of your books that's going to be made into a Disney film sometime soon, I think. An animated movie.
Last I heard, possibly 1984. It's an ominous-sounding year, but they've been working on it for quite a while now.
Yeah, I thought they were going to do with 1984 what they've done with the 13th floor and a lot of buildings, which is just pass over it.
They may well do that.
So do you want to have any input into the movie?
I don't have any, and I'm very glad for it in a way for a couple of reasons. First, it's a different medium, and the requirements of film, I think, are quite different from the requirements of novels, literature, and so on. And I'm not familiar with that medium, and for one thing, it's different. It's going to work differently. I know the movie is not going to come out the way I wrote the book. I mean, I know that. I'm quite sure that's the way it's going to be. My concern is if it's good in itself, okay, that's fine. But I'm glad not to have input because, first, psychologically, I don't think I could. I mean, I conceived of the Prydain books as novels, as literature, and somehow I can't change my conception of them to another medium. I couldn't make a sculpture out of it or something, and I'm very happy just to sort of butt out of that and see what happens.
Probably the Disney people are relieved in the sense that, from what I've heard, one of the most disliked presences around film studios are writers, because writers want you to be faithful to what they've written.
That's right.
It could be a real problem.
Sort of stay away. We're on fine terms, but there's 3,000 miles between us. It'd
be interesting to see what happens with the characters if it's made into a movie, because it... once a movie's made out of something, the characters are like born into a larger world, and they just they if it's a popular film, they'll become part of the vocabulary.
I'm fascinated by it. I have no idea how it's going to go. I hope for the best. I gather that indeed they are trying to do their best. They're very serious about it, and it's and they say more than that you can't ask. So see what happens.
We're about out of time, but I'm wondering what kind of letters you get from your readers about the characters and the situations you've created.
Oh, marvelous letters, Terry. I get almost as many letters from adults as I do from kids, which is fascinating.
I think I'm not surprised to hear that.
I get, and this is fairly recent, for a good many years, most of the kids who wrote letters were girls. For some reason, and I don't know why, within the past year, it is now almost half and half. And of course, they're magnificent letters. Some of them are, very straightforward. Read your book, send me your autograph or something. Actually, this is the smallest percentage. Most of them are very perceptive, and they are telling me what is in the book,
mm-hmm.
and asking about certain things and giving their opinions. And they're beautiful letters. Marvelous things.
I'm glad to hear that. Listen, I want to thank you a lot.
Thank you, Terry. I could have gone on for another week or two.
I've been talking with Lord Alexander, who's based in the Philadelphia area. He's a writer who's received many awards for his children's books, which are obviously also read by a lot of adults. His most recent book is called Westmark. There are a number of earlier books. They're all published by Dutton. And you might want to look out for The Black Cauldron, which will be made into an animated film by Disney Studios probably in a few years. And, thanks again for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Terry.
Enjoyed it. It's 17 minutes to 3, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. I want to remind you that in about 15 minutes at 3 o'clock, we'll be featuring part 2 of the Pound Williams Conference. And one of the speakers today will be James Lachlan, who published on his New Directions Press the writing of both Pound and Williams, and he'll be reading from their letters to him. And Lloyd Alexander's work has also, by the way, been published by New Directions. And so that's at 3 o'clock, excerpts of the Pound Williams Conference. 3:30, it's Interval with Francis Davis and part 2 of his series on the work of pianist Paul Bley. At 4 o'clock, my guest will be broadcast historian Eric Barno, whose newest book is on magic and the early cinema and the relationship that the early cinematographers had with the magicians of the period. It's really interesting stuff. So that's coming up at 4 o'clock today. About 3 years ago, folk singer Malvina Reynolds died, and she will always be remembered for her songs and her spirit, the humor, her politics. Her famous songs are Little Boxes And she's written a number of other songs that I'm sure you remember, What Have They Done to the Rain. Recently, a station on the West Coast produced a documentary for the NPR system, which we're about to hear. And one of the people we'll be hearing from in this documentary is Malvina Reynolds' daughter. We'll also be hearing from Pete Seeger.
When you die, that's all. Like everyone, like every other creature, there comes a time when you're done. I certainly hope I go in a big puff of smoke or something so that I'm not hanging around, becoming a burden on other people. That's the thing that we old people hate the most.
Malvina Reynolds, The Bard of Parker Street, A Portrait in Sound.
The undertaker will get my dough, the grave will get my bone, and what is left will have to go for one of those granite stones. But this suit cost me 2 weeks' pay, so let it live another day.
Malvina's daughter, Nancy Schimmel, talks a bit about her mother's background.
My mother, Malvina Reynolds, almost did go in a puff of smoke. She died in 1978 after 2 days of severe illness. You may not recognize her name, but you may have sung a song of hers, Magic Penny or Little Boxes, without knowing who wrote it. She was 77 when she died and working on an album called Purely Political, released posthumously as Mama Lion. She was political, just about all her life. She was denied her high school diploma during the First World War because her parents were socialists and opposed the war. She went on to the University of California anyway, and after having me and marrying my father, Bud Reynolds, she got her PhD in English there at the age of 36. She never taught, though. There was a depression on, and she was a socialist, a woman, and a Jew. Bud was a carpenter and grassroots organizer. Malvina was a social worker for a while and a newspaper columnist. During World War II, she worked in a bomb factory. Then we moved to Southern California, and after the war, she got involved with People's Songs, where folk singers and songwriters were getting together to perform their songs of social significance. The performers were mostly local, and when Pete Seeger came through, he took his turn on stage with the rest. When I went to Cal, my parents followed me back to Berkeley, settled on Parker Street, and Mom had her first hits, Harry Belafonte recording Turnaround, and then Pete Seeger recording Little Boxes. Here's Pete's version of what inspired Malvina to write Little Boxes in 1962.
She and Bud were driving